let me in.
Shibba, shibba.
I want to be closer to you.
Shibba, shibba.
Open up your soul.
Shibba, shibba.
Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. There are a lot of you out there who are familiar with Theater Rhinoceros, but if you aren't, Theater Rhinoceros was founded in 1977 and is the longest running LGBTQ theater in the nation. They've got some award-winning shows, and they've got some shows that are, I don't want to say it. I will let our next guest say it. Here, I'd like to welcome director, actor, producer, John Fisher. Hello.
Hey, Marilyn. How are you?
I'm doing great. How about you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on the show. Yay.
So let's talk about the show that you've got coming up called Doodler. And this is my first time hearing about this historic thing that happened in San Francisco. So can you talk about it to our listening audience?
Yes. In the 1970s, there was a serial killer called the Doodler, and he focused on gay men. He killed gay men only. Mm-hmm. And they think that he had sex with them and then killed them. So that's part of the mystery. Why would somebody do that? Also, he doodled them before he killed them. So that's the way he charmed them. He went up to them in bars. He said, look, I've drawn a picture of you. It's a doodle of you. They got to talking. It led to a seduction. They went out to the beach. They had sex. And then he killed them. And they were savage murders. And they've never been solved. To this day, they are unsolved. They do not know who did them.
So when this all went down, did the authorities take it seriously, or did they do that thing that they used to do where they, if they didn't approve of the lifestyle, they didn't really give it the attention it deserved?
Yeah, exactly. Your second proposition, they didn't approve the lifestyle, and they, you know, the police were famous in the 70s for abusing gay people themselves, for beating them up, for throwing them in jail for no reason, for extorting bribes out of them. So they really didn't pursue the case properly, and people didn't want to hear about it. You know, the newspaper didn't really cover it properly. So there were all these other things going on, like the Zodiac Killer and all that stuff, mm-hmm. which got a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. The Hillside Strangler. But the Doodler got very little.
So in the community, how did, like, was there word of mouth that people said, you know, beware of this person? Or when did it come to light that there was this person that was the Doodler?
I think it sort of spread amongst the community. The community itself wasn't very communicative about stuff either, because a lot of people were in the closet. They didn't want to talk about it. Some people actually survived the Doodler's attack, but they would not give testimony in court because they would lose their jobs, because you could fire people for being gay. So there was a lot of really kind of, you know, closeted behavior, which in a way made the Doodler possible. The Doodler kind of stopped at some point suddenly. Mm-hmm. The Doodler was not one of these people who wanted attention, like the Zodiac Killer who wrote letters to the Chronicle saying, hey, I struck, I'm going to strike again. The Doodler did not want attention. I think as soon as he realized what was happening, that people were kind of on to him, he stopped, which is sort of unique in serial killer history. So the community wasn't really in a position to protect itself because it wasn't very transparent with itself about what was going on. That was 1974, you know, it's very different now.
Right. Was there ever any talk about, because you said some people survived, so were there ever any suspects?
There was a suspect. I don't put a lot of faith in the police department and its suspect.
Sure.
It seems very strange. There was a suspect that did a drawing of this person, but the police won't tell you anything about this person. They say it's an open case. We can't talk about it. I mean, to this day, it's an open case. Mm. So I'm sort of like, why is this a suspect? And how is this a suspect? And so Yeah, there was somebody that the police say they're very suspicious of, but the case is open and they've never been able to bring this person in and provide enough information about them to proceed in a court trial. I mean, I just, so yeah, but I don't really buy it. Mm-hmm. It seems a very prejudicial supposition on the part of the police. So, you know, the police are very compromised in this case, as they were in anything related to gay people in the 70s, in relation to any minority in the 70s. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's a suspect, but I think there's no suspect. I think the dude war is gone.
So now you're doing a one-man show called Doodler at Theater Rhinoceros. Mm-hmm. How did you find out about this serial killer?
Well, I was doing solo shows during COVID. I gave myself a week to develop them and perform them on Zoom. Mm-hmm. And this was just the week I was interested in serial killers and gay people. I'd been doing a bunch of shows on queer myself, and a lot of them were not about queer subject. I said, I have to do something gay. I went online, and this is the first hit I got for some reason.
Wow.
Online. It was all about the doodler. I was fascinated. I was like, my God, I never knew. Uh-huh. There were other gay serial killers at the time, the Tenderloin Slasher. You know, so it was like this horrible thing going on where gay people were just being killed, and the police weren't really doing anything. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wow, that's a great subject. So as with all my solo pieces, I sort of inserted myself into it. I tried to imagine if I was 18 at the time, you know, and kind of wanted to, you know, be a hero, how would I get involved in this? So that's my character. Mm. My character embarks on kind of a lifelong pursuit of the doodler.
So just to go back, when the doodler suddenly stopped, did that same MO ever appear anywhere else?
Nope.
Really?
They never heard about that again. They never heard about the doodling, the going to the beach, the having sex first, the murdering. No, that didn't come up again. That was the doodler's very specific MO, and the doodler stopped in 1975. He either killed 5 or 16 people. They don't know. Somewhere in there.
Wow.
No, at least 5, because it was so clear, the MO.
Mm-hmm.
But it could have been more. But as I said, there were other gay serial killers. So
right, and you mentioned that there was a survivor, or were there more than
one? There were three survivors. Who one of them said he would identify the doodler in a lineup, but he would not give testimony because he had a job. He was queer. He knew that if his boss found out, his boss could fire him, because he could, back then, you could fire somebody for being gay.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm not going to give testimony in court because that's public. He refused adamantly. And the other two also refused. They were kind of celebrities. One was a local celebrity. One was a national entertainer. They both said, I will not give evidence.
Wow.
Which, you know, probably had to do with their public persona. And so nobody who survived would testify in court.
That's just nuts. So if you fast forward to today, are those victims still alive?
I don't know. It's a very weird case still, because there's very little about it available. There's online resources. You know, the SF Weekly has written updates about it, you know, when the SF Weekly was around. The Chronicle, you know, there's a podcast. But the police aren't saying anything. I think it might be because of their incompetence, and they're trying to cover their tracks.
Mm-hmm. Though it could be that it was one of their own.
Well, that's interesting. That's a very interesting comment. And my character actually says that to a cop. How do you know a cop didn't do it?
Right.
And the cop goes ballistic and says, well, that's not the way we kill people. We beat people to death. We don't stab them. You know, and the cop's just completely cynical about it. And, you know, that's made up. I mean, that's
you're
part
right.
of the drama of it. You're right. But that's a very interesting comment.
So
that's a very interesting comment, yeah.
So in writing this, what other things did you discover about that time and place?
Well, another big incident, and it is the night of the Castro 14, when the police came to the Castro and tried to take it back for the Irish. It was an Irish neighborhood. The Irish cops decided, we're going to go down to Castro and start arresting gay people and beating them up. And it was crazy. I mean, 14 people were arrested, but dozens more were beaten. I mean, savagely beaten by the cops.
Wow.
And so it was a war between gay people and the cops at the time. you know, they were going to take care of everything. They were going to take care of the hippies. They're going to take care of the gays. You know, it's, mm-hmm. you know, they were going to clean up the city. They're going to get the city back to the way it was before the 60s, you know, and it got weird.
So go ahead.
I discovered a lot. It was, a lot of it was very disturbing. The show is very hopeful. I mean, the character's kind of finding himself and coming out of the closet and realizing that gay people have to take care of themselves. And, you know, so it's a hopeful show, and his journey, he encounters a lot of interesting people, and some mm-hmm. of them are very comical, you know, not that I'm making fun of them, but just it's an entertainment. It's not just this, and it's not a documentary. It's not just like we're talking. It's mm-hmm. it's a story,
mm-hmm.
but his journey, I intend to sort of illuminate a lot of things about San Francisco at the time.
Now, I'm in reading your bio about this show. It sounds like you're doing everything. You're doing the lights. You're doing, like, yeah. Is that true? You're just a one-man
oh, yeah.
everything?
Yeah, I always try to, you know, do something different with my solo pieces. What's the challenge? And so, yeah, I mean, when I did in New York, I did a workshop. I ran the lights. I ran the sound. And this time, I'm also going to be the only person here. So when the audience arrives, I'll check them in, tell them, you know, there's self-serve wine bar, there's self-serve concessions and cookies, the bathroom's over there, I'll answer questions, you know, and so then I'll go into, you know, prep mode and
right.
do the show and send them home. It's just me.
Wow. So you're the one that yeah. they're going, hey, we're out of napkins. You're like, I'm on it in the middle of the
I know.
Show.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, how do you serve people? How do you really serve an audience? And I've done all these things, you know, mm-hmm. being an artistic director, I've served cookies and stuff like I've done all that, but now I'm putting it all together. It really is a solo show. And it arises out of two. First of all, it's sort of like saying, you know, this is solo. The doodler was a solo guy.
Mm-hmm.
The guy stalking in my character is a solo guy. We're working on our own. And I kind of embraced that in telling the story to make it more exciting and something new for me from when I did it before on Zoom, you know. And I mean, I have a lot of help. Crystal's like handling the, you know, Crystal will send me a list of names, mm-hmm. in the box office and, you know, marketing. I mean, there's a lot of help.
Right.
But
the night of the shows.
On the night of the show, I'm it, you know, and I can call for help and say, oh, my God, I'm down here and these people are being so mean to me and all they want are more cookies and I don't have enough cookies. What should I do? And somebody will say, well, calm down. Why don't you go next door to Molly Stone and buy more cookies? And I'm like, oh, yeah, that didn't occur to me, you know. Right? I mean, you know,
yeah.
usually my panic is like has a totally obvious solution, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, you know, but, and also it's, you know, it's a tough time for theaters and we just did a huge show, Cabaret, and we have another big show, Gumiho, coming up. And I sort of thought, virtue of necessity, why don't I just, you know, lessen the financial footprint on my piece,
mm-hmm.
embrace it as part of the aesthetic. So I don't have to have a stage manager down here. I don't have to have a house manager down here. I mean, it's just, you know, and, you know, just keep it simple.
Right.
And, so, you know, this weekend I'll meet with the lighting designer and he'll, you know, he'll set it up. But, yeah, I press the button and I throw the switches and, you know.
Yeah, and yeah. given the state of theater post-pandemic, you know, it's sometimes it's just a matter of necessity to wear all those hats at once, whether
yeah,
you want to
I
or
mean,
not.
Yeah, I mean, let's be real. I mean, so it's like I could just keep putting on shows and paying all this money. But it's like, you know, we're doing two big shows and
mm-hmm.
this is the one in between. And mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, and I honestly think people are going to have a good time. I mean, I work up a sweat. It's not going to be like me sitting in a chair smoking like, oh, this is my stories. You know, I really, you know, they're going to get as much out of a one-man show as anywhere else in town. But they'll also get me, you know, tell them where the wine is and,
right,
you know,
right,
where
right.
the napkins are for the cookies, and you know.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, when and where for Doodler?
It's at Theater Rhinoceros in the Castro. It's a Castro story. This doodler did his business, his horrific business in the Castro, so it's
mm-hmm.
a local story. It's
mm-hmm.
in the Castro.
Mm-hmm.
It's at 4229 18th Street, which is just a block from Castro Street.
Mm-hmm.
It starts February 6th, and it runs through March 2nd. It's Thursdays through Saturday nights at 8, Sundays at 3. You can buy tickets online at therhino.org, therhino.org. We have a variety of prices, but nobody will be turned away. If you just want to come see the show,
mm-hmm.
call me up, leave me a message at our phone number, and we will get you in. So, you know, it really is for the community. We're not a community theater. We're a theater for the community, and we want everybody who wants to come to come.
Yes. Excellent. Excellent. And I had one other thought, which is possibly the reason why the doodler stopped was because in trying to kill someone, he himself got killed, you know, and the person who did it wasn't going to say anything.
That's so interesting.
I mean, would you?
Thing. I mean, the first thing you mentioned, I had thought of the cops. The cops were doing it, but I never thought of that. Maybe the doodler just died, or maybe the doodler got killed by some sort of vigilante.
Not even a vigilante, like just picked the wrong person.
That's true. I mean, three people managed to escape, and I don't know the details. Again, there are very few details that we're privy to. The police has all the info, but I portray one of those people fighting back viciously. So the idea that, you know, there's just a bunch of weak gay people out there sort of being victims, I think is belied by, you know, we see that gay people fight back, but maybe you're right.
It happens.
People got killed. Yeah.
It does happen.
Do you want to give away tickets?
I do want to give away tickets. How about a pair of tickets?
A pair of tickets.
Which night?
For February 7th.
Okay, I'll give away a pair of tickets then.
Yeah.
John Fisher, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, my pleasure, Marilyn. It's always a pleasure. I love that you cover so many different things, and your insights. Or it's good to talk about it. You know, like doing my solo thing, I'm sort of off in my own little world, and I don't think about these things. Maybe that'll be in the piece.
All right.
A doodler got killed, you know.
All right. Well, John Fisher, once again, thank you so much for being on the show.
Okay, Marilyn. Take good care.
You too. All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity. You can win a pair of tickets to go see Doodler at Theater Rhinoceros on February 7th. Just give me a call here at 346-5376. Thank you. You're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. That's Miles Davis and Dîner au Motel. That is from Elevator to the Gallows. Who's about to touch your mind right now? Well, I have an Emmy-nominated actress and singer with a passion for preserving African-American stories through music. I'd like to welcome Paris Lane. Hello.
Hi. How are you, Marilyn?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
So, Paris, tell me a little bit about what's your background. When did you start acting and singing?
Oh, my goodness. I don't think we have enough time for that, but years ago, I started as a stage performer, doing musical, and then with the bands and then choirs touring Europe. And I have a very versatile voice, so I was able to be hired in different genres to perform. And so that's what I did. And then I started producing shows and one-woman shows, and then I went on to writing and so forth. So, but it's been a couple of decades.
Okay,
let's say that.
Did you start as a kid, or did you come to it as a grown-up?
Oh, as with singing as a child, especially with spirituals, it was part of our family tradition that during the thunderstorms, the lights would go out. They had oil lanterns, and the curtains were down, and we had to sit in the living room. Couldn't play the piano. You had to be quiet because it was when God was doing his work.
Oh.
And my great aunt and my mother would do a call and response, and the children would gather in to sing the spirituals. And that's, I always say I learned spirituals like Trinity, because I learned it first at home, and then my next door neighbor was a minister of music at the Asbury United Methodist Church, and she was a graduate of Howard University. And she used to practice, and I could hear the spirituals through the walls there. And then we were directly across the street from the Baptist church. And when they opened their windows, and the music would just float up into into the windows. It would flow into the windows. And so I learned it that way.
I'm wondering if your mom and grandma did that so that you guys wouldn't be afraid of the thunder and lightning, that it was just a way of reframing it.
I think it was not necessarily being afraid. It was more out of respect, saying that this was the time to be quiet and still. I was told a lot of the enslaved people did that as well. And then there are certain ethnic groups in Africa that does the same thing. They just keep still during that time period.
I love that. I love that. Now, you're hosting, in honor of Black History Month, you're hosting the Abella Listening Room Experience. Tell our audience about that.
Okay, Abella is a historical fiction music audiobook that I wrote. It was part of a independent study that I did at Mills College, and then when I went to Goddard College, I had transformed it into a music audiobook. But the story is about an enslaved girl with a unique singing voice, and she gets sold to a music teacher that teaches her how to read and write and cultures her. And she sends her to New Orleans, which was under French territory at that time, during that period. Mm-hmm. And because New Orleans, the French would allow the enslaved people to have Sundays off and then gather together at Congo Square. She became popular there. And then people started hiring her to come and sing in their houses. And then she went to France and she became famous. And all of the money that she made, she sent back to the States to purchase the freedom of other enslaved people. So the story is basically about the music, because she's singing it, and how it starts off with a child's view and being a female of what you have to go through. during that time period, and how the overseer wanted her to sing, as well as the enslaved people while they were getting whipped. There's 26 spirituals in it, and I not only narrated the book, but I perform and arrange and produce all of the spirituals. So it's the, with the listening room, I'll take certain portions of the book where you hear the narration, and you get to listen to not only the parts of the narration, but also the songs. And a lot of times when people are singing those type of songs, it's more, how can I say, polished. It's extremely polished and put into, you know, the modern art form. I kept it as raw as possible so mm-hmm. that when you listen to it, you actually feel like you're right there in that time period. And that's how you feel like you're going on that journey as she evolves, as she grows up to become an adult woman, from a childhood to adult woman, and her singing and her playing the piano, the struggles of learning how to play. You know, here's the minor keys are always the black keys, and the mm-hmm. major keys are the white keys. You know, little things like that, and the torturing. I did not leave out the torturing, the events occurring regarding the torturing or the techniques that they did use during that time period.
What was the spark for the creation of this experience, and also, is it a one-woman performance, or are there a number of people who are involved in this?
What it started out was I was doing Negro Spirituals as a workshop, the communication through songs. Mm-hmm. It was a program with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra called mm-hmm. Arts Excel, and I would go into the schools that nobody wanted to go into and teach the children that when you communicate, what you put in, you put junk in, junk comes out. And to give them history, to understand that the importance of learning. And then while I was doing my research at the Library of Congress, I decided I had to do a spiritual CD, but I never got to it.
Okay.
And then when I moved out west and I started thinking more about it, the CD, but I wanted to do something else with it. And I thought, well, what if I create a story, you know, involving someone that sings spirituals? Because all the, you see or look at any of the enslaved stories, there's nothing about the music, and the music played a huge part, not just from healing, but messages, how to escape, and so forth and so on. And so I had a lunch date with Quincy Jones, and I ran the idea about him, and he was like, that's good. Did you thought of that? You know, and I started asking him questions because he did the music to Roots.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm from Annapolis, Maryland, originally, where Kunta Kinte came in on the slave ship. And so he started telling me about how, you know, his experience with doing the music for Roots. And when he said to me that it was a good idea, that's when I started to sort of, you know, embed it. It was the seed planted in my mind. You know, you think of things and you put it off and put it off, but the seed was planted in my mind. And so I just gradually started going on and on. And once I got to Mills, did it as a little short story, and then also the entire story. It's the independent study.
Wow.
And I just forgot the second half of your question. Sorry about that.
No, is it a one-woman show, or are there other people involved?
Yes, well, I In a way, it is. There are people that I did use in the book itself,
mm-hmm.
Where I have a violinist there, and I had someone to play the piano for when a classically trained pianist for when she was learning how to play piano from a regular pianist for when she was learning how to play, and then a classically trained pianist for when she actually played. But because there's another character in there that played the fiddle. And so I had, you know, a violinist to play his part. Other than that, pretty much all me. So the event will be a one person, you know,
okay,
show in a sense of that. Because it's a very intimate setting, so people can ask questions. So if you're into singing or writing or narrating, or you want to learn the history,
mm-hmm.
It's all there.
Okay.
It's all there.
So for our listening audience, when and where?
Okay, it's coming up the first Sunday in February.
Okay.
And it starts at 3:00, and we'll have some snacks and all of that good stuff there. But the location is 1067 Market Street, and it's in Suite 5008. It'll be there 3 to 5.
And I know exactly where that is. It's right across the street from the Civic Center BART station.
Yeah,
you can just get out there.
Yeah, and you can get the tickets on Eventbrite.
All right. And then for people who want to know more about what you do and the things that you've got coming up, how would they go about finding that out?
My website is www.parris, parrislane.com. And you can go on there and find out about everything that I'm doing, will be doing again. I just completed a residency over in Oakland at Jefferies. And that was a jazz renaissance show that had tap dances. It's just like the Cotton Club review.
Oh, cool.
And so I will be going back to Jefferies to do that in June.
Excellent. And so for our listening audience, you're going to be doing it every Sunday in February, starting
every
at 3:00?
Every Sunday in February, 3 to 5.
Okay.
So and to give everyone a chance just to come in and to have a Q&A afterwards. So that, you know, because it's a lot, you know, right now we're going through a lot of things where our history is being erased.
Right.
And so I feel that it's an important time to keep us alive, you know, and for those who do not know, you know, a lot of people just don't really know our history. We have a lot of people, African Americans, that do not know mm-hmm. the history, and Africans as well. And I say that because the artwork, I had an African artist to do the artwork. And I had to explain to him about slavery here in the United States so that he could actually capture in the painting mm-hmm. what I wanted. So.
Well, thank you for doing that education and outreach. And once again, where can they get tickets?
Go to Eventbrite. Mm-hmm. And you can sign up. You'll see it in Parris Lane. And Parris, always remember, it has two R's.
Mm-hmm.
Parris Lane. And you just put Parris Lane in there, and it'll come up about the tickets.
Okay. Well, Parris Lane, I want to thank you so much, not only for being on the show, but for developing something so powerful to be done during Black History Month.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Marilyn. I truly appreciate it.
You're welcome. All right, people of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out Abella, a voice for the voiceless, and go enjoy. If you want to hear a little bit of it, I'm going to play some right now.
Oh, hallelujah, amen.
Great, my children.
Great, 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 till Jesus
comes. Jesus
comes. Great, great, great.
Tis me, I am Lord. Standing in the need of prayer.
Groovy Baby, that's Billy Abbott. The name of the song is Groovy Baby. Before that, we got to hear a sample of the Abella Spirituals that Paris Lane will be performing at the event. Well, you know what? It's the first last Monday of the month. Because, you know, New Year's and all that. And as you know, I love to have my librarianista here. I got three of them now. So it's a red letter day for everybody. I would like to welcome librarianistas Allison Wyckoff.
Hi, Marilyn.
Megan Merritt.
Hi, Marilyn. Happy to be here.
Thank you. And Ted Barrow.
Hi, Marilyn.
Excellent. I've got, you guys are doing it great. So, first of all of you, when did you guys decide you wanted to be librarians?
Well, None of us are librarians. We're just lucky enough to work at the library, but we work in different capacities. So Megan and I work in the exhibition department. I'm the director of exhibitions. Mm-hmm. And Megan is a senior curator, and Ted is a guest curator that we invited to co-curate the Skateboarding San Francisco Concrete Community and Continuity exhibition, which we'll be talking about here today.
Okay, well, let's just jump right in. Tell me about this skateboarding dilly-boo.
Okay, well, I should just say that I did want to be a librarian since an early age. I'm just not yet a librarian. But
you still can be.
I know. I suppose that's true. Hopefully this will get my foot in the door. But I did grow up skateboarding, and though I didn't grow up in San Francisco, I really did grow up worshiping at the altar of San Francisco skateboarding, which to my mind was the most radical, diverse, and hip community of skateboarders, and also one of the most like world famous crews from the late 80s up until now.
Really?
Yeah, so people who don't skate don't appreciate how important and central San Francisco is to the global history of skateboarding. So this is an exhibit that really celebrates that from, you know, this Bay Area export to the rest of the world.
Okay, okay. So I've somewhere in the city, I think maybe I saw it at the museum, at the Modern Art, that they had a skateboarding installation.
That's correct. Yeah, that's Unity Through Skateboarding, which was curated by Jeff and Gabe from Unity and Their Skateboards. Mm-hmm. And that's very much consonant with our exhibit. You know, we work with a lot of the same people in that, and it tells a similar story, which is about how these communities are formed through this shared activity in an almost nonverbal form of communication. Mm-hmm. and athletic and cultural production. But ours is very much rooted in the Bay Area and its built environment and its own history about how community formation has helped to infuse and kind of like make San Francisco skateboarding exciting.
Well, it's exciting to watch skateboarders, but it's also terrifying because we've got these crazy hills, and you know they're just flying down, and you know sometimes it doesn't even look like they can stop.
Sometimes they can't.
Ugh. And so it's you know, you have to have a certain amount of a feeling of invincibility to be willing to go down these hills.
I think that's one of the draws of San Francisco is that that it has this incredible topography. Mm-hmm. And there's no other city like this in the world. And so it does offer the most intense terrain, as well as one of the most, as anyone who skates or doesn't skate can recognize, it's a beautiful city. It's incredibly unique. Mm-hmm. And so not only is it this intense terrain, but it's also this like spectacular backdrop for skate videos, skate photography, and just it's like every skate photo is an advertisement to the rest of the world to come skate San Francisco.
Okay. So this exhibit that you guys are doing at the library, when is it happening? Where is it in the library system?
Yeah, so the exhibition opens on February 3rd, mm-hmm. And it runs through July 6th. February 13th.
February 13th.
About that, Marilyn.
Day before Valentine's.
That's right, yeah. Okay. And actually, that's when our opening reception also takes place.
Oh, okay.
So if you can join us, we'd all love to see you.
Oh, okay.
It's a free event. It's at the Public Library in the Jewett Gallery. That's on the lower level of the main
library. Okay, yeah.
Yep. And we have some really exciting satellite displays is what we're calling them, but they're mm-hmm. kind of smaller exhibitions that take place throughout the main library. And those are on view sort of opening on different dates throughout the run of the exhibition. Mm-hmm. And they're from the second floor to the sixth floor. We've got a really excellent display from the skateboarder Carl Watson. He's world-renowned local skateboarder. He wrote a children's book called My First Skateboard. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a really great display of his in the Children's Center and some programming that you'll have to tune into our website to learn more about.
Okay.
On our third floor in our James C. Hormel LGBTQIA Center, we have queer zines.
Mm-hmm.
Those will be on display starting in March and will run through June. We also have in our Arts, Music, and Recreation Center on the fourth floor some vinyl picks from skateboarders featured in the exhibition. So those will be really cool, and those will be able to check out from the library and take home.
So when you talk about vinyl picks, are you talking about LPs?
Yeah.
Wow, because I hear that LPs are making a resurgence amongst the youngins because they like to actually have some, like they like to have physical things that they can interact with.
Yeah, exactly. I think there's, you know, it's this analog throwback, and it's it's really cool. So we'll have that display, and you can take home, you know, if you see one of in our interviews, which we're going to feature in the main gallery, you can hear about the skaters kind of connecting with the music that they love to skate with, and you can take home one of those albums.
Wow. What are some of the ones that are the skateboarders really connect to?
I think the story that sticks out for me is Tommy Guerrero talking about skipping school in the, I think it was the late 70s, and he saw the Ramones play for free at Civic Center in front of City Hall, and he said it shaped him forever, and it left this indelible mark. So I think that for me is what has stood out.
Very cool. Very cool. So once again, that's the February 13th, and it's going to be running for how long?
Until July 6th.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's nice. That's nice. So that's a hard hard act to follow. What have you got to tell our listeners about?
Yeah, we have an exciting lineup of exhibition-related programs that will run throughout the show that are intended to expand people's understanding of skateboarding and the impact that skate culture has had on the artistic and cultural landscape of San Francisco, the Bay Area, and the world. And so we are using different modes of engagement to bring people in to learn more about the exhibition and to see just some of our incredible highlights. We are working with many skateboarders and skate organizations. We've got a couple of series that people can tune into. So one is a series of, we're calling them TED Talks.
Okay.
It's curator-led exhibition tours that are both inside the gallery and will take people outside into the city. We are working with Tiratana Espiritu Productions on a series of activations on Fulton Plaza that is called Skate, Rock, Roll, Read. So it brings together skateboarding, the library, music, and the SFUSD to just showcase different talents across those different areas. We have Poetry Slam that's multidisciplinary, that's being curated by the local writer Jose Vadi, and will feature poetry, different types of reading, music, dance. That's in April. And we, are looking at Bay Beats performance. I can't announce that yet because the exciting musician that we are hoping to work with hasn't confirmed yet.
Okay.
But then we'll close out the exhibition with a panel discussion that is really focused on the arts, like art of skateboarding and artists working within the realm of skateboarding. So stay tuned for information about that, visit the website.
So are you three people who have skateboarded, you know, in your past, in your recent past, obviously, because you're pretty young looking?
I think I'm the only lifelong skateboarder here. In terms of recent past, last time I went skating was 2 days ago, and I'm still sore from it. But, I've skated my whole life. It was my way into the world. So I that's the kind of experience and background that I'm bringing to this show.
Okay.
Okay.
In putting together this show, what were some things that you discovered that maybe weren't readily apparent to you, you know, before you put this show together?
Well, I think one of the funny things, so we announced the sort of title as San Francisco Skateboarding, Concrete Community and Continuity, as this idea of the built environment, the communities that form in these places in San Francisco, and the continuity, the future of skateboarding, and how it appeals to kids today. One of the things that I realized early on was just the importance of concrete as a building material for San Francisco. If you think about an earthquake-prone city with steep hills that asphalt won't stay still on, concrete is the foundation of the actual city and the reason why so many people skate here. I was in my research, I was...
I never even thought that there was a difference between asphalt and concrete. Yeah. To me, it's all the same.
Asphalt is, you know, those little pebbles on the tar,
and
concrete is what the sidewalk is made of. And I was, in my research, I was going through this interview with this woman, Karen Zapata. She was a skater, Bay Area skater in the 80s. And she had this great quote where she said, she's talking about skating on other people's property. She says, it was very punk, taking the concrete paved world, working with it and skating it. Mm-hmm. Concrete became the canvas. We'd figure out a cool way to ride the wall instead of screaming at the wall. And I kind of loved all of these little moments of rebellion and finding your place in a concrete jungle and otherwise kind of like hostile or uninviting environments. And so I think for me, what at least I realize in working on the show is just the multivalent ways that skateboarding and San Francisco have fused and kind of enhanced the people who do these things, enhance their lives and their outlook. And also that, you know, Carl, here's a cool thing. Here's something I found out during the interview. A few blocks from here, on Divisadero, Carl Watson and his family move into an apartment that had been formerly occupied by, rented out by Tommy Guerrero, who was like the kind of like most OG, like legendary professional skateboarders from San Francisco in the 1980s.
Okay.
Carl Watson became a professional skateboarder in the mid-1990s randomly, not through knowing each other. They just moved into the same apartment just a few blocks from here. So to me, that really speaks to how small and intensely like epic like the scene in San Francisco is, and also just how local it is, you know?
Now, I understand, because I found this out, that there's some sort of online place where skateboarders can look and find out, like, oh, this place has a really cool railing, or, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And are you aware of this?
Not only am I aware of it, I think I narrate it.
Oh, okay.
I work for Thrasher Magazine, and I do a show called This Old Ledge, where we... where I talk about the cultural and architectural history of skate spots, both in the city and globally. But yeah, there are numerous websites where people have pinned spots and, you know, talk about the pros and cons of each obstacle and what, you know, what you can do, what's been done and where it is, most importantly.
And does that include private property?
No comment.
It does then. Okay. All right. So once again, for our listening audience, when and what's the name of the event? Where can they learn more about it and participate?
Yeah. So sfpl.org is the San Francisco Public Library's website. And all of the information about the exhibition, about the satellite displays Megan mentioned, and all of the exhibition-related programming will be on the website. So people can go there and look for exhibits and events. The opening reception is February 13th. It's a Thursday. It's from 5:30 to 7:30 in the Jewett Gallery at the Main Branch Library. And all programs are free.
Excellent, excellent. And if people want to know more about skateboarding in general and what you guys do outside of the library, how would they go about doing that?
Well, I think there are a ton of organizations locally doing great work. Skate Like a Girl is one that's based here and in Portland, and I think maybe they do work nationally. Brujas is another organization that's BIPOC-led, female-centered, female and non-binary-centered. And then SF Skate Club is an organization also on Divisadero that introduces young people to skateboarding. There is also a kind of a DIY, maybe a little bit rogue event that happens every Tuesday at 5 o'clock on Fulton Plaza outside the main library. And I believe it's Epic is the name of the organization, but they bring skateboards out and teach people how to ride boards.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Allison Wyckoff, Megan Merritt, Ted Barrow, I want to thank all three of you for being on the show today.
Thank you, Marilyn.
Thank you, Marilyn.
All right. People of Earth, this is your opportunity to go check out skateboarding at the San Francisco Public Library. They gave you a whole bunch of resources that you can look into to find out more. Maybe if you have a kid who's a skateboard aficionado, you can point them in the right direction and keep them from getting hurt. Speaking of getting hurt, Mr. Ford is going to hurt you with the grooves he's got coming up. I'm going to leave you with Thomas East and the Fabulous Playboys. I Get a Groove. Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.